Hi, welcome to In the Know with Dr. O. We're recording in the Esports Innovation Lab within the University of Cincinnati 1819 Innovation Hub. I'm David O., Chief Medical Officer of Hoxworth Blood Center. Hoxworth is the blood and blood services provider for all hospitals in Cincinnati and the surrounding tri-state area. We're fortunate to be joined today by Dr. Christina Preuss. Dr. Preuss is the Associate Director of Transfusion Medicine and Director of Hematology and Coagulation in the Clinical Laboratory at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. She studied organismic and evolutionary biology at Harvard, then received her MD from University of Illinois. She did her residency training in pediatrics at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia, and then subsequently did two fellowships in Cincinnati, one in pediatric hematology oncology at Children's Hospital, and one in blood banking and transfusion medicine at Hoxworth Blood Center, part of the University of Cincinnati. She then joined the American Red Cross as the medical director for the Pacific Northwest before eventually returning back to Cincinnati. Her research interests include the intersection of global health, sickle cell disease, and transfusion medicine, most recently projects concerning alloimmunization in pediatric sickle cell disease patients. Wow. So we'll go into that a little bit.
Absolutely.
One of the first questions we ask folks is, as a superhero in the field of blood banking and transfusion medicine, what's your origin story? So where are you from? What did your parents do? Let us know.
Yeah, absolutely. So I came from a family that was into medicine. I grew up in Chicago, Illinois, well, technically one of the suburbs, Arlington Heights, if anyone's from
that
area.
Yay, go Arlington Heights.
It's a great place. too cold in the winter.
I grew up in Wisconsin, which some people consider to be a suburb of Chicago.
Yeah, pretty much. At least the southern part of it. So that's where I grew up. Both my parents were pharmacists. They were more on the retail side of things. So my mom worked for a mail order pharmacy. My dad worked for actually the same place before moving to a more specialty one. And they always said, please do whatever you want to do. We don't care.
So that's great. Fabulous.
So I was kind of just able to explore and see what my interest was and what my interests were. And so as I kind of went through, my studies, obviously I got to take a lot of really interesting classes. And as part of that, there was always a flavor of global health in there. I always loved to travel.
Okay, wait. Let's go back to high school. So what were you like in high school?
Oh,
what was your interest before you decided to go to college?
Oh, man. All right. So in high school, I was a super band nerd. It was amazing. I really have to credit the band program at my high school. And shout out to Mr. Jacoby, who was, he just got everyone so excited about band. Like, even if you were horrible at playing an instrument, you just wanted to be there. It was really amazing.
And what did you play?
I played flute and piccolo. So I started out flute, and then as I started to gain my seniority, I finally was able to pick up piccolo as well. That little piccolo solo in Stars and Stripes Forever, that was my thing.
It was great.
We went on a European band tour, actually. We got to go once every 3 years, and as part of that, we played that song in Vienna. So, I just have this memory of being in the, Vienna Public Library, and we had this big concert, and standing up and playing my little piccolo solo. It was so much fun.
That's part of your travel adventures.
Absolutely.
Like,
that was one of my first times, of getting out of the country and doing a homestay and really seeing how other people live so differently than us, no matter where you are in the world. So that was kind of the first little piece of travel. And then, of course, my college roommates were from all over.
You decided to go to Harvard.
I did.
So what led you to that decision? And
it really was about feeling. So I knew I wanted to leave Chicago. I knew I just had this travel bug within me of just, I need to see some other part of the country that's not here.
Gotcha.
It was great. I love Chicago. I hate the winter, but still love Chicago. But I just needed to go somewhere else. And my parents were thankfully very supportive of that. And they said, wherever you can get in, sure, go for it. We will support you. So when I did, the classic college tour of going around and seeing which one feels right, I learned really quickly that I got a feel for the campus without really needing to try. I remember there was one college we went to, I stepped foot on campus. About 5 minutes later, I'm like, nope, I cannot go here. So we finished the tour and everything, but I was just like, it just doesn't feel right. And then, when we started to go to some of the East Coast schools, I really immediately, the millisecond I was on Harvard's campus, I'm like, this is for me. And I love Boston. It is my favorite city. I would, you know, go there in a heartbeat if you know, life ever worked out that way.
Anybody listening from Harvard, right? Who's hiring, let us know. So did you go intentionally as a pre-med student then?
No. So what's nice about Harvard is that they don't have a traditional pre-med. It was a, you know, we will help you. Like, these are the courses you really need to take to be able to take the MCAT, but you pick whatever major you want. And so I picked one that really was truly speaking to my interests. So I'd always loved animals, and I'd always loved, you know, studying animals, being outside, hiking. And so I did the one that I did, organismic and evolutionary biology, which is a lot of words to basically say the study of animals and plants and organisms in general, except for humans. There was a separate one for humans. I didn't take that one, oddly enough. But I loved it. And as part of that, I got to take these classes that not only were not related at all, but I also got to take classes that were very intertwined with global health and travel and animals and all this sort of thing. And so I remember there were two courses in particular that really still stick with me today. One of them was a course on human health, public health, and it was with Paul Farmer as well as a couple other people. And so, you know, if you're not familiar with Paul Farmer, he was really big on like global health. The research and really trying to promote this idea of supporting everyone around the world and trying to bring like better health to everyone. But it was also a really big part of always having sustainability. So you don't just go in there, you bring your money and be like, here's some, you know, HIV medications and then say, see ya. Like, he really worked with them to develop clinics, to develop ways to continue to have these resources going forward. And so it wasn't just, you know, set up a clinic at leave. It was set up a clinic. Let's figure out how patients in this country can afford to pay for these medications and make this a sustainable long-term practice. And so that's always really stuck with me, because I feel like a lot of research that I see, or at least some of the global health research especially, we see that people kind of show up to a country, they do their little research project, and then they leave. And, you know, there's really no long-lasting impact. Or even so, some people show up, they take what samples they need, and then they leave, and then they do their testing somewhere else. And gotcha. So it's always been a really big goal of mine that as I start to progress in my career, I want to be able to do this research and keep it in the country that it's in, because that is so critical, I think, in order to help improve the health of everyone. So that's one piece. And then the other class that was really impactful for me was actually, we spent 8 weeks in the rainforest. So it was really wonderful. It was a summer school class. So I did, you know, kind of take that extra step of, I'm just going to study all summer. That's okay. But it was on the island of Borneo, which is in Southeast Asia, partially owned by Malaysia, Brunei, and Indonesia. And so I was in the Malaysian part, and this was a course with people from Southeast Asia as well as people from Harvard. And so it was a really cool class, to be honest, to be able to study plants and animals in their natural environment, but also get to meet people from around the world and make those connections and learn about others as well. Because, you know, at night in the rainforest, you're not, you know, turning on Hulu. You're going to be, you know, listening to the frogs around you and just chatting, because what else is there to do? That's great. It was wonderful. But at the same time, we also got lectures from various people. And one of them was the course director's wife, who is a physician. And she was talking about her initiatives in Indonesia, where she was in these tribes in Indonesia. And while she was there, she set up a clinic. And she was working directly with the people living there, saying, okay, we will work on giving you reduced cost healthcare. You can trade with us. So bring, you know, whatever you happen to be growing or making, whatever it is that you sustain your life with, come trade those goods with us and we will give you healthcare. But we also want a little bit of extra of, we want to make sure that we're preserving your landscape. And so if you do not cut down more rainforest, if you do not hunt these rainforest animals that are so valuable to the planet, we will continue to help provide you guys healthcare. And so I thought that was a really interesting model as well, kind of thinking outside the box of how do we support the local community and be able to provide healthcare, but also kind of protect the world around us as well. So those two things really stuck with me, and they still do today, and really try to drive everything that I do in when I go in and do this research and showing up in these countries where they may not even see tourists all that often, if ever, but being able to go there and not feel, I don't want to feel like a tourist. I want to feel like someone who's trying to really impart as much as I can into where I am, and then teach as much as I can. And so I've been able to do that so far, and it's been really awesome.
That's really great. That helps me understand a lot more. So, okay, so you finish undergrad, mm-hmm. then what happens?
Yeah, so I went straight into med school.
Oh, you did. So you decided then, as you got in organismal and evolutionary biology, that med school made sense as the next step for you.
Yeah, yeah, I did a little bit of shadowing here and there, like a lot of people do, and figuring out that, hey, medicine might be a thing for me.
Gotcha.
And so, yeah, I just jumped right in. And
did you think pediatrics then from the very beginning?
Sort of. I think I was one of those med students who kind of kept changing their mind every time they did a new rotation. Like, oh, this is really cool. I like this.
I was not that student, actually. But go ahead. I know of you. Yes, yes.
Right?
That's awesome. That's awesome.
But no, I really liked a lot of what I was doing. I mean, sure, there were some that I really didn't like. I didn't like internal medicine. I figured that out pretty quickly, but I liked the more like procedural, hands-on kind of things. So okay. I actually was really into surgery. I really liked OB-GYN. Like, I really had a great time, but at the same time, there was just something about pediatrics that just kept drawing me back. And I don't know if it was the kids. I don't know if it was getting to work with the kids and the families, but there was just something about it. And then on top of it, early on in my medical school career, I was, talking to my family. Obviously, I was, far away. I was in central Illinois. But, we kept in touch a lot. And I got this call that my cousin was diagnosed with cancer, my little cousin. And so, that was really tough to go through that, to not be able to, be there for them because, med school is so grueling. You can't just leave every weekend. You can't just leave every day. And so I just wanted to, my way of contributing and my way of trying to help was to learn as much as I can. And so that ended up leading me to read a lot about pediatric cancer. And so I really got very interested in it from that perspective as well. And so I think doing that reading, being very interested in it, being really involved as much as I could with my cousin, who is doing absolutely wonderfully right now. Shout out to Maya because she's awesome.
So,
so yeah, she's actually in college right now. She's doing a study abroad in Europe, so she's having the time of her life. But yeah, so doing all that just made me be like, well, I really like pediatrics. This feels like a good fit for me. And so I just kind of kept going forward. It never really looked back. As I went through, I really started to work with the heme-onc clinic at my med school, and it had an association with St. Jude, so they actually had a lot of patients coming through, especially because it was one of the big referral centers for Central Illinois, which is just a lot of rural areas. And so I was able to get some research going, write a couple little small case reports, and so it kind of got me back into this research mind as well. And so I just kept going in that direction.
Excellent. So you decided to go to pediatrics.
Yeah.
And you chose Virginia.
I did.
For your residency.
I did.
What drew you there?
I really wanted to, again, live somewhere I hadn't lived before. And I wanted to be in a program that was not huge, but not tiny. I wanted to see as much as I could, but I also didn't want to be in somewhere where there's so many people that it's super easy to get lost in the crowd, or it's just so competitive that, unless you're the top two people, you don't really get a lot of attention. And I also was starting to really think in the back of my mind, I think I want to go the peds hemonc route. And so I wanted to be somewhere where there was a fellowship for peds hemonc, just in case that is something I wanted to do, so I could continue working towards getting research, because you'd really need research to get into that specialty. So I looked all the way around, and of course I was couples matching as well, so that also brings in a little layer of complexity, and ended up at Richmond, Virginia, which turned out to be an absolutely wonderful place to be. It was one of our top choices, and it turned out to be exactly what we were hoping for, which was a really close-knit family of people and very supportive. I mean, none of us were really cutthroat or trying to bring anyone else down, and I was luckily the only person in my class who wanted to do PT Monk, so it really was convenient from that perspective, too. And then, of course, I got to know the whole department very, very well. And so probably too well. They were probably tired of me after a while. And they're like, oh, please just go somewhere else. But what was, I think, really life-changing for me about that as well, and what really changed my direction, was that there was a really big sickle cell population there. And so because of that, so many of our patients that we take care of on the floors were sickle cell patients, which was a very different demographic from where I did med school. And so that was really a big introduction to what sickle cell means, how to take care of children with sickle cell and how to support them and how to really try to change their perspective, because sickle cell is a lifelong disease. You have to take a medication every single day, whether you feel well or not, to try to improve your hemoglobin, and so or your hemoglobin F. And so because of that, it's really hard sometimes to convince, you know, a 5-year-old that you got to keep taking your medicine every single day. And then teenagers, gosh, forget it. You know, it's really hard as a teenager, because everyone, you know, it's an awkward phase anyway. And then to have to take some medication that no one else has to take in your friend group, I mean, that's really hard. And so I really just had the best time working with these kids, and just spending time chatting with them, trying to distract them from their pain when they were admitted for pain crisis. And it really started to solidify my love for taking care of sickle cell patients and trying to help sickle cell patients. So, you know, it's just kind of, it was not the direction I expected, because I really thought I was going to stick with the peds oncology side, because that's where really I got started. But, you know, just the impact of these patients just kind of shifted me the other direction, and I was really happy with that.
So you were really oriented towards benign heme then. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So so 3 years in Virginia, is that right?
Yeah.
As your residence. And then they had a fellowship program. You decided not to stay there, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I was really honest with them, and I really wanted to have a good relationship with them.
Oh, yeah.
And so from day one, I said, you know, you guys know I love you guys, and you guys know that I've had the best time learning, but I really want to get, you know, apply all over and try to get into the biggest program I can, try to get into the best program I can, because this is just, you know, this is your time to learn, and this is your time to see as much as possible. And they were 100% supportive. You know, they said, you know, we really want you to be here. And I think they were, at the end of the day, sad that I left, but at the same time, they said, you know, we understand, we want to support you, we want to help get you there. And I think that's how I ended up being here in Cincinnati at, you know, one of the best, if not arguably the best program in the country.
Yeah, Cincinnati Children's Hospital is just such a fantastic resource and organization in the area. Recently ranked right number one.
Yeah.
Which poll is that? I'm sorry, you probably have to...
The U.S. News and World Report.
Thank you, the U.S. News and World Report. And sickle cell, incredibly strong here.
Yes,
as well.
yes, absolutely.
That must have been competitive to get here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they take 5 fellows a year, and they interview at least 40 to 50 people, if not more. I don't know the exact numbers, but, you know, they really, there's a ton of people. And on those interview days, it's so stressful, because you're one of, you know, 7-8 people vying for one of these spots. And you're like, not even all of us on this interview day can go here.
Yes.
And, you know, it's really stressful. And it's still a match, just like a lot of the other subspecialties.
Oh.
And so you don't know where you're going until match day. And they, you know, just tell you. So it's really stressful, but it was one of the most exciting days of my life when I opened up that email and saw it. And I cannot say how many people in Richmond were just like thrilled for me. They were just beyond excited. And so it was really great to have that support, and great to get to come here.
So how long is a pediatric hemoc fellowship?
It's 3 years.
Another 3 years.
Yeah, another 3 years. Yeah, right. Most of the, if not all the pediatric fellowships are 3 years. So they're pretty long. And really, they have to be that long. So for peds, hemonc especially, and a lot of these other subspecialties in pediatrics, there's a big component of research. And so really, the first year was all clinical. It was, you know, you're basically living in the hospital and you don't leave very much. But then the last 2 years are almost entirely dedicated to research. And so there's a big emphasis on, you have to have a project. You have to, you know, think through your project, and you have to produce something, because so much of pediatrics, especially these subspecialties, is focused on trying to improve and advance our field because research has historically not been huge, right? There's so many things that we use off-label for medications. There's so many deficiencies. Like when you go to ask a question, you're like, oh, let's see what's in the literature. For adults, you know, you'll have 30 studies pop up on your question. For peds, you might get one or two like case reports out there. So they really emphasize research, and it was really nice to have that dedicated time, because some programs you do more clinical work because they just need the help. They don't have enough fellows, et cetera. And what's nice about Cincinnati is that they really do say, this is your research time. You have, you know, your clinic day and a little other things in there. But for the most part, you are doing research. And, you know, I think that's why I was so successful with my research project, was that I had all this time, and it was just, you know, all day, every day, it's get your stuff done.
So who did you work with on your research?
Yes, I was very, very fortunate. I talked to Dr. Russell Ware early, probably middle of the way through my first year. And for anyone who doesn't know him, he's a really huge sickle cell researcher. He's done a ton of work with hydroxyurea. And really, I think even now he's, I would say, internationally known for his work, especially with hydroxyurea in sub-Saharan Africa. He's been an incredible mentor. I mean, he's someone who, you know, will push you to get to, you know, your absolute best, but also, you know, knows how to be, you know, really understanding, and just really just helps you get through your project and make sure that your project is something that is doable, feasible, something that is publishable. So I cannot even begin to say how grateful I was to get to do that, because I got to work with one of the premier sickle cell physicians, and I got to do a project in sickle cell, but also was related to transfusion medicine, which is how I started to slowly make that migration. And so, of course, being in the Ware lab was a really great thing. I got to learn so many research techniques. I got to you know, do PCR. I got to do genetics work. So it was really great. And then, I, of course, you know, his two main lab people, Thad and Katie, just taught me everything, and it was so wonderful. And I wanted to do this project as well, and why I was so intrigued by it. And so
tell us about your project.
Yeah. So Russell, Dr. Ware, when I was talking to him, said, you know, I've had this idea, but I haven't had the right person come along to do it. It's like, huh, let me hear your idea. And then I said, yep, I'm the right person. This sounds amazing. So the project was looking at pediatric samples that had previously been collected in a study that was done in the Dominican Republic. And so these were just frozen samples that had been hanging around, just waiting for someone to test them. And so we had this idea to look at alloimmunization in this population, because...
So what is alloimmunization?
Of course. So so alloimmunization is a ridiculously long word that I have to say so many times in my talks. And so it's a process where, when you receive a transfusion of red blood cells, either whole blood or components, usually outside this country, you're probably going to be getting whole blood. Within this country, you're probably going to be getting a component, just packed red cells. And what happens is, if those red cells have an antigen on them that is not something that an antigen that you have. So, for example, you know, we all think about ABO, and we all know that plus or minus after the ABO. But really, for blood bankers, we get super excited, and I particularly get really excited about all the other antigens, all, you know, 36, 37 other blood groups that are out there. And so what we think about with alloimmunization are these other blood groups. So you think about your D, your C, your E, and your K with sickle cell patients. And then there's, you know, tons more. But essentially, if I am someone who has a positive big C, and my blood, I donate my blood, and it goes to someone, and the recipient is negative for big C. They don't have that big C antigen on their outside of the red blood cell, similar to like an A or a B. And so if that recipient gets my blood, and for whatever reason their immune system is kind of revved up that day, or, you know, we don't understand the entire process as to why it might cause a reaction, sometimes it might not, but if that recipient gets my blood, their immune system could say, I don't recognize that big C. That doesn't look like something I've seen before. So they make an antibody to it, similar to like an infection or anything else, but this is an antibody to something they really shouldn't be. But then again, it's, you know, not what the body's used to seeing. And so that antibody, unfortunately, sticks around for, you know, the rest of the person's life. And so if that person were to then get another unit that was big C positive, then you could have a hemolytic reaction. The red cells could all break apart and could cause problems in the recipient.
Yeah, so we like to talk about, just to kind of reiterate what you said, sometimes we tell our donors, hey, if you're O negative, you're a universal donor and everybody can get your blood. And that's like half of the story, right? That's actually 95% of the story, right?
Yeah.
But for 5%, 1% to 5% of recipients of blood, they will end up forming an antibody. And it's much higher rate of actually antibody formation in sickle cell patients. Mm-hmm. Right? So another tragedy of sickle cell is that because of the disease process, they just form these antibodies more commonly. And so that O positive that should be great for everybody has other red cell antigens or markers present on the cell. And we have to worry about those 37, you know, 40 different red cell antigens because a person could form antibodies to any one of them, especially if they lack that antigen. And so that's kind of the research that you're describing, I think, is those folks who form antibodies and just can't get transfused with anybody's blood. It really has to go through a special process of testing and being compatible.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah, and so you know, you mentioned you know there's a higher rate of alloimmunization in sickle cell patients. You know, here in this country, we think maybe it's about 7 to 8% ish. A lot of places will try to prophylactically match. So we know that you're a sickle cell patient for whatever reason. We know that, and so what we like to do is get a genotype on you. We like to see what is your predicted phenotype. So what are all the antigens that you have? What are the ones that you don't have? And then once we go through that, we will ask our wonderful blood center to please give us really special units of blood for our patients who may need just a simple transfusion. So they may just need one unit. And we say, can you please give us a unit that doesn't have this antigen and this one and this one? It's a whole laundry list. And then, you know, we you know, hopefully you guys have that rare unit, which a lot of times you do, which is pretty remarkable.
Amazing, yeah.
You know, we have an amazing community here and you guys are awesome. So I feel really lucky that we have those units available. And then sometimes for these patients, they actually get chronic transfusions. So they need to get a red cell exchange where essentially you're hooking these patients up to a machine. You're taking out their red cells, their sickle cells, and you're putting in these fresh cells. But you can imagine in kids, some, you know, the little kids thankfully don't typically need this procedure. It's more as you get older and you've had a stroke in your life. But when you get to, you know, teenage years, you're essentially adult-sized, and an adult has not just one unit of blood in their whole body.
Right.
And so we're talking 8, 9, 10, you know, depending on how big the person is, having to give all of these special units to this patient in order to avoid making these alloantibodies. Because if they do make the alloantibody, not only do we still have to avoid that antigen, but then if we don't avoid it, like let's say there's an emergency and we have to give antigen positive, or they go somewhere else and someone's not aware of this process, those patients could be at risk of hemolysis.
Yep.
And so that would obviously be very devastating.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's really interesting research. And so you are going to do research on populations that have not had a ton of testing, right?
Yep, exactly. And so this project that I did in my fellowship in the Dominican Republic, it was the first time in you know anywhere that they've really described how many alloantibodies are seen in patients out there. So it was really massive that I was able to show this work and say, like, hey, I did this testing, and I was able to talk to the leadership at the hospital even out there, and I said, you know, this is a problem, because while we said 7 to 8% here, it was closer to 20% out there, and so that's a lot of alloimmunization that they are just not aware of because of various limitations in testing and reagents and everything.
So your path in pediatric hematology oncology really was so much more technical and really blood center activities than I don't think any other fellow that I've heard of. You know, it's such a perfect match for us. So Dr. Gonzalez, my director here and head of Hawksworth Blood Center, went and saw a talk that you presented, right? It's part of the WARE lab.
Yes.
And he, I think, dropped his jaw and said, oh my goodness, you need to spend your life, another year of your life, with Hawksworth Blood Center to do a second fellowship. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so there's actually a whole lot more backstory.
Oh, is there?
Oh, it's so great. So there's this weekly this weekly presentation where it's called Floor Meeting. And basically all the research labs get together and someone gets up there and presents their research, and people in the audience will tell them, like, oh, that's great. Or more likely they say, oh, that's a problem with your research.
So if it's Dr. Gonzalez, it's, oh, that's a problem with your research.
Yes, yes. He sits front
Have you
and
thought
center.
Of that?
He sits front and center every single time. And, you know, it's really, it can be very stressful.
Oh,
because,
yeah.
You know, you're work so hard on this, and to have someone say, well, your premise seems wrong because of this, yeah. it's hard, especially in front of a lot of people. Yes. So, you know, they're always very stressful. And I remember the week before my presentation was, I watched one, and this guy, like, was not doing well. And so I was, you know, I was very nervous for him. I felt terrible. And then after the floor meeting, you know, Russell called me to his office, Dr. Ware called me to his office, and he goes, so we're supposed to be giving floor meeting next week and we don't have anyone, so you're going to do it.
Oh no.
So I had 1 week to put this all together, and I was panicking the whole time because I knew Dr. Gonzalez was going to be there.
Oh,
because,
yes.
You know, you put blood in there, like, he's absolutely going to show up. And so I, you know, somehow put this whole thing together, stressing out about it. I get up and present, and I had a couple of really nice questions. And I remember Dr. Gonzalez was just quiet.
Oh.
I don't remember him saying a whole lot. I think he asked, you know, a question or two about just, you know, the patient population. And then afterwards he approached me and goes, that was really good.
I
almost fell over. I mean, I barely knew him. And to have him come up, and my only impression of him was, like, he asked those hard questions.
A lot of hard questions.
And he seems to know everything. And so I was so nervous because this was his, you know, his field.
Yes.
Like, he's the Hawksworth Blood Center guy.
Yeah.
So it was really good to have him come up and say, that was really good. You should really talk to us. And so, you know, one thing led to another. And it's one of those things where, you know, you just – opportunities just kind of appear and you just need to take them if it feels like the right thing. And so he said, you know, we really would be interested in you as a fellow. And I said, well, tell me more about this. And it was a weird time too, because this was right around the time of trying to figure out what I was doing with my life,
right.
Because I didn't know where I wanted to go next.
It wasn't that long before, you know, you were going to finish your fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a position open for you in July 1, right?
Yeah.
And you had to make your decision. And I told Jose, I remember he told me about you, and I was like, she's not going to come. She's got, you know, she's planning the rest of her life, you know? But you made the decision. How'd you make the decision?
Yeah, it was, so I honestly, and you know this too, I went into this with the impression of not being a transfusion medicine physician full-time.
Definitely. And that's how we accepted you, knowing, oh, we're going to supplement you with some skills and way of thinking that will allow you another year in this area that you've already delved into yourself. So it was great for us because you already had so much interest in it.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember for my research, I had to essentially learn how to be an IRL tech. I had to learn how to do tube testing for alloantibodies, which is pretty technical work. And so I had already knew how much I didn't know about transfusion medicine because of that, because I'm doing all this trying to learn as much as I can. But I swear every time I would learn something else that I had to read about. And so it was really just so much to learn. So I decided, you know, in order, if I'm going to keep doing this research that is so closely related to transfusion medicine, I probably should know more about transfusion medicine and understand the backside of it, the side that a lot of the clinicians who see patients don't ever see. You know, one of my favorite things is teaching fellows, you know, hem-onc fellows, pediatric residents. Like, I love teaching all these clinical people because I now know what they don't know. And
yes.
So I know, you know, what to kind of push and what to say, like, hey, you probably will not learn this. So now you're going to learn this, and you're going to have such a better appreciation for why it takes a little longer to get your typhon screen back than you expect. So it's really nice to have that. And so I really wanted to go into this transfusion fellowship to have that, you know, that ability to say, like, yes, I've studied this, I know this, and I understand it on a deeper level, but then go back to, you know, just being a pediatric hematologist, but just have that kind of transfusion piece on the side. But unfortunately, or fortunately, whatever you want to call it, as I went through the fellowship, I realized more and more how much I loved this field.
Yeah.
And how it really was something that I just couldn't stop thinking about, reading about, and how I really, it just felt like the right thing to do to fully switch over to the other side, the dark
side.
So
I remember when you started talking to me about wanting to do this, transfusion medicine, instead of, you know, pediatric hematology. And I was just shocked. I was just so shocked. And I apologized to you because I'm like, oh my gosh, that's a total, you know, switch from what you were doing. But there's so much cool stuff, right, that happens in transfusion medicine. And it's so funny you talk about training the fellows, and because they don't know anything that happens in the blood bank. It really is a black box for the ordering physicians in a lot of cases. And so for you to be on the other side of that, you know, much more than I ever was, and to have been waiting for your results and like, why can't I transfuse this? What's going on? Why is this incompatible? And to actually really then understand, you know, what happens in the laboratory is great. And then what we do, many people in our field, is that's why we spend our time, is to instruct then the clinicians who are ordering our tests exactly what's happening when they order and why it's taking long and what the results really mean and the significance of it. So so I apologize for kind of altering your course here a little bit in terms of the course of our studies, but I'm really glad you seem to be very happy kind of with this choice. And you've kind of, you know, made some pivots since then as well. So you spent the year with us. You did a fabulous job. We
Thank
really
you.
Enjoyed having you, asking tons of questions, improving our processes, and then deciding to, I think personal decisions helped a little bit in terms of location of country.
Yes.
After you finished our fellowship, you decided to leave and go to the Pacific Northwest. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So the year that I was doing the Hawksworth Fellowship, it was right in the thick of the pandemic. Yes. So it was a really weird time. You know, there were times that we were in office. There were times where we couldn't be in office. I remember my first week, like literally my first week as a fellow there, I got a COVID exposure. And so I had to go home again. I'm like, this is wild.
So that was 2020 then, 2020 or 2021.
Yep.
Gotcha.
And so during that year, and part of, you know, why it was a really tough year for me in particular was that my my partner was out in the Pacific Northwest doing his training. He's also a physician, and he had gone through the match. He was doing his second fellowship, and the match had put him out there, which was great because he was super excited about the program. It was a great place for him to be. He also loves the outdoors and everything. But the only problem was Portland, Oregon is a little far away from Cincinnati, Ohio.
And that was one of the things that I thought, oh my gosh, you're never going to do this fellowship here. If you know what I mean? That's a huge sacrifice to be able to just get more of the backstory, you know, in terms of the techniques that you're using and some of the, you know, scientific basis, laboratory basis of what you're doing.
Yeah.
But you decided to make that change for a year.
Yeah. I mean, it was doable because there had an end date. Yeah. Like, we knew this was 1 year. It wasn't a 1 year plus maybe I'll extend it, like maybe whatever. So that made it a lot easier from just a mental health kind of standpoint. Yep. And then at the same time, I still had this other research project with the Ware Lab that I really wanted to finish that just kept getting delayed with the pandemic. And I had received an award from Children's Hospital to do global health research. And so this project that I had come up with was separate from the Dominican Republic. This one was going to be in Malawi, which is in sub-Saharan Africa. And so I had this grant. I really wanted to get this project off the ground, but I just kept getting delayed because the country of Malawi was physically closed to visitors. They would not let a single person in. And so not even for research or anything. So it was sort of a waiting game as well of like, I'm going to wait a little bit. I'm going to try to make this happen. And so I was really hopeful as well that being able to be at Hawksworth would allow me to still maintain my connections with Children's and be able to get this research going within that next year. Of course, it didn't happen. It you know got pushed back by another year. But it was still something where I could continue to be in contact and work with the team together and, you know, hopefully make it all work out. And of course, it all worked out.
And that was one of the things that we were really fortunate here at Hawksworth. We have such great relationships with Children's Hospital and, you know, UC, of course. And so it was no problem for us at all to say, oh, your research time is already, you've already spent so much time with Dr. Ware. It's such great quality research. You continue to spend your time doing that. That is transfusion related as well with his group. And we'll just try to support you in your time that you were here. So.
Yeah. And I really appreciated that. And I appreciated the flexibility of saying, you know, you could have said, no, you have to think of a new project with us. Yes, like these other ones don't matter. But, you know, you guys were really supportive, which, you know, again, was a great reason why I stayed on because I like the people. Yeah.
So you decided to go to the Pacific Northwest, mm-hmm. and then you took a position with Red Cross.
Yeah.
So so I will say my history was very similar to yours. After I finished my fellowship, my first job was with Red Cross, and I stayed for about 2 years. So tell us about your experience there, because I know you talked about blood banking and going into transfusion medicine, but then we're split up into two different parts. One is blood center side, and one is transfusion service side. And again, you surprised me because you're like, no, I like the blood bank side, the blood center side. And that's really, you know, donor center activities with the Red Cross as the national, they collect about 40% of the blood nationally. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yep. So yeah, so I was really fortunate that a job opened up with them in the right location at the right time. And so I was able to interview with them, and they liked me enough to take me on, even though I don't know how many non-pathologists they have on medical director staff. But it was great. And it was really intimidating to think that I would be really overseeing two states and right out of fellowship. Yeah. But it was really helpful because my fellowship was really blood donor center related. Yes. And so I felt like I had all the tools that I needed to be as successful as possible. And then of course I had you as my backup, like, hey, what would you do in this scenario? And there were a couple others in the Red Cross in my region who were absolutely wonderful and were always there to help me talk through something, and they would talk through things with me. And so it was really wonderful. It was a great experience because not only was I able to help out with these two regions and really get really deep within the blood center and understanding how regulatory works and everything, because that was, I think, always my weakest point, was I never had a lot of the training on, like, you know, CLIA and all these things. You know, as a clinician on the clinical side, you don't really ever think about that. And so that was really good to understand that on a deeper level. And then, of course, Portland had an IRL. And so I did to look at their cases, hear about fun things that were going on. So that was really, really a great piece of that. And then, of course, I still had this research project in Malawi that I wanted to get done. And I had just the most wonderful group with me who said, you know what, we are going to make this work. And so, you know, I went from, you know, having this all these people who were like, okay, we'll take your call, we'll help you cover this, and I can sign out some things remotely. So it all, like, thankfully worked out to where I was able to go there for a month and get my research done once the country opened back up. So it was, yes, it was really a wonderful thing. And I was really happy that they were flexible and said, you know, yeah, we will help make this happen.
Great. So you and your partner are out in the Pacific Northwest for 2 years, is that right?
Yeah.
And then you're back in Cincinnati. So what happened? How did that happen?
Oh, that was so surprising as well. And again, it's, you never really expect to know where your life is going. And then it just kind of, you know, things just happen, and you kind of have to take those opportunities that come up. You know, I had always said, and he had always said, we don't want to live in the Midwest. We don't like the Midwest. We're not Midwestern people. You know, it's, you know, I love to be on the beach or in a forest or by, like, an ocean, you know, and we don't really have much of that out here, but that's okay. You know, it's, you never know where your life's going to take you next. But I just remember I had heard that, well, first of all, when I graduated from Hawksworth, Children's didn't have any openings anyway. So there was really no opportunities there. So I knew I was going to be going somewhere else anyway. And then I heard that really unexpectedly someone was leaving. And it was really nice because this person was in charge of coagulation and also helped out with transfusion medicine. It's like, that sounds a lot like my background. You know, I've done PC hematology and I've done transfusion medicine. So once I had heard about that, I just kind of threw my name in and said, hey guys, I know you know me, so maybe you'll take me back. And so they were really, really wonderful. And thankfully they said, yeah, we'd love to have you.
So your predecessor was actually also a former fellow, right? From Hawksworth, if I'm thinking of the right person. And he left for personal reasons. And he's got a great job now.
Yeah.
In Kentucky, I believe. And the person who was, I think, you work with very closely now and who has made a lot of decisions in terms of the hiring of that, had experienced you when you were a fellow.
Yeah.
And, came through. And of course, you spent time with Children's Hospital. And you probably spent more time than others. And she was so excited, you know, that you were interested in coming back. And we all were. And so So congratulations. So what's your current role with Children's Hospital?
Yeah, so I am the director of hematology and coagulation for the clinical lab. And so I oversee all of our testing and troubleshooting and problems and helping our clinicians when they have consult questions regarding anything with that. And then I'm also the associate director for transfusion medicine. So I am pretty key in the blood bank, helping to make decisions, helping to consult on issues that come through. And of course, once I joined, Dr. Kinney was very happy to say, hey, all the genotype workups, you can absolutely interpret them. Like, yes, please send them all my way. Because all of our sickle cell patients get a genotype done. And so for some of those, we have to do further workups on them. And so and for some of those, we have to, you know, come to Hawksworth and say, hey, I know that this patient has, you know, a positive little C, but it looks like it's a partial. So can we please try to avoid giving this with transfusions? And so that's part of my role to decide, you know, is this an antigen that matters, or is this an antigen that we can kind of ignore? So it's been really great because there's just so much diversity in that, in the Rh gene. Yeah. So it's been a lot of fun to think about those.
Yeah, you for the listeners out there who are blood donors, or we know ABO and then plus or minus, right? Mm-hmm. There's so much with the plus and the minus yes. that goes on. It's so complex. Yes. There's so many variants that are out there. And one of the things we still struggle with, I think, in terms of thinking about transfusion medicine and compatibility.
Yeah. And if you want to know more, I did just recently give a grand rounds at Hawksworth on
right.
this very topic. So you should check out the website, because I do go a little bit more into detail about that, just kind of understanding why the genetics are so diverse and why it is that we focus so much on sickle cell disease with these variants as opposed to focusing on every single person.
And the talk really covered a lot of the global activities that you're involved with now. And so it's just fantastic that you're able to come back full circle and really be active in some of these. Maybe you'd briefly mention one or two of them.
Yeah, of course. So it's really in life, you end up making connections with people. And that's how I, again, found this new opportunity, which I'm so excited about and got to really talk a little bit about it in my talk. So one of our co-workers, he's our microbiologist, Dr. Mortensen, and he happened to have a relationship with a lab that was starting up in the country of Guinea. So this is Guinea-Conakry, so in West Africa. It's a French-speaking country. And he's had this relationship. This is a newer lab. They're building this pediatric clinic, the first pediatric clinic in the country. And there's these two American trained physicians as well as a Belgian trained physician who are, you know, just starting this up. And while he was over there, he was really helping with the microbiology piece because that's what he does. And, you know, once I joined the group at Children's, he was like, oh, you sound like you're someone who might want to help out. And so he's always trying to solicit people to help out with some of these different areas that, you know, he doesn't have as much expertise in. So initially it was, hey, you should help them out with their hematology, you know, like malaria and reading like abnormal cells, things like that. And then I was fortunate enough to actually get to go with him and meet everyone and help out with reading slides. And I also got to do some learning on my own too. I mean, I feel like a malaria expert now because I've read so many positive sure. malaria slides. But then I also got to see what they needed and where I can continue to help. And so after talking with their medical director and their lab and really investigating how they did all their processes, I realized that they have a huge need for sickle cell treatment and transfusion support. And so that's going to be hopefully my next big step in my life is trying to really help this lab become incredibly robust with doing, you know, great transfusions that are safe and then also having a good sickle cell program.
So especially in sickle cell disease, there are treatments that are out there that are not blood transfusion. Mm-hmm. And we always conservative about wanting to transfuse blood. Mm-hmm. Just because we have it, we don't want to transfuse it. And a lot of people say the best transfusion is the one that you don't give,
yes.
right? So there's a drug out there, hydroxyurea, which Russell Ware has very much an expert
yes.
on. And recommendations are that people with sickle cell disease, you know, take this in much larger numbers than they currently are. Mm-hmm. And if they do take this, They increase their levels of a different form of hemoglobin, mm-hmm. and that allows them to function better mm-hmm. Long term. So it's a treatment that I think we all kind of want to see more widely implemented. But again, as you talked about in the very early part of our podcast, you don't want to drop in the country, provide something, and then not have a system to mm-hmm. support the use after you're gone. And yeah. so really it is an implementation with an understanding of how long-term those treatments can continue to help people. And then they can avoid a transfusion as much as possible with all the complications that are there and all of the difficulties of providing transfusion in an area that has limited resources.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really hard to think about, you know, how to help in the best possible way too, because, you know, when you think about it, you know, us here, you know, I have a transfusion reaction form and I just tell my techs like, hey, you know, do our standard workup and then we'll kind of go from there. And the standard workup here is nowhere near what they have the capabilities for right now over there. And so I just think back to a couple weeks ago where, you know, thankfully, we're in this digital age where I can very easily communicate with the country of Guinea. And so, you know, we're texting on our phones back and forth, like sending pictures and things. And so they reach out and they say, hey, we have this patient. Their sickle cell disease, we're worried that they're having a hemolytic reaction. What do we do? And so I got to talk them through while thinking about their limited test menu, trying to talk them through how do we figure out, is this person having a hemolytic reaction? And how do we know when it's safe to give more blood if they need more blood? Because, again, they don't even have hydroxyurea available. It's only a recent thing where they were able to find a way to get it into the country. And so just thinking through this, you know, these patients do end up getting a lot of transfusions, potentially more than here because they don't have that hydroxyurea to help mitigate that. And then on top of it, I have to work with very limited availability of assays to really say, can I transfuse this person again or not? Because that is the scariest question, I think, when you're having sickle cell with hemolysis is when can I give more blood? And so, you know, we were able to work through this and, you know, sending pictures and like spinning down tubes and trying to figure out the right way to do it. And so I think, you know, part of how I'm trying to give back to them is that I'm essentially on call for them all the time, whenever they want to reach out and
time zones.
Ask me questions.
Oh, no.
It's great. It's all right. I don't get woken up in the middle of the night, thankfully. but yeah, it's just been really rewarding, and I hope to start bringing some new things to them in the near future to help with their sickle cell.
Well, it's so exciting, and that presentation you just gave last week was just so interesting. So I'm so glad we had you scheduled for today to come and talk to us. One thing we ask our guests usually before we sign off is, and I guess I'll mention, I know you donated blood, fairly recently, and so. What would you say to somebody else who's considering donating blood, who maybe hasn't donated blood before, if they're like, oh, should I donate or not donate?
Well, first of all, I say everyone should try something once before you say it's not for you. So definitely give it a try. And that is coming from someone who cannot handle her own blood.
So you're surrounded by blood all day long, right?
I know. It's so embarrassing. So I remember in med school, one of our tasks was you give yourself a finger prick, you put it on a glass slide to look at it under the microscope to understand what these cells look like. And I remember I did the finger poke. I tried to put on the glass slide, and I immediately sat down on the floor because I'm like, I'm going to faint. And it's been a problem ever since. You know, every time I go to the doctor, like for only my routine
blood draw,
I have to like talk to someone else. I have to, you know, pretend to be somewhere anywhere other than getting my blood drawn because I will faint.
I was like, get a picture of Dr. Proust donating, and you're like, no. It's not going to happen.
Maybe the next one. but again, like, you know, even though I was so scared and so just like uncomfortable with this, I know I'm an O neg, so I really want to be helpful as much as I can. And so I just remember I'm like sitting in the donor chair. I have like 25 towels on me, every fan in the donor center on me. And they're like, do you want us to stop? And I said, no, I'm going to get through this. Oh, and so I did it. I made it all the way through. So I'm telling you, if I can manage to donate blood, I'm sure you can as well. So at least give it a try once before you say it's not for you anymore.
Oh, fabulous. I love that story. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we end?
No, I think this has been great. I think I really appreciate having Hawksworth here, and I like that we have this podcast to kind of talk about these pieces of blood that we don't necessarily get to talk about so much.
We're so happy to have you back in town, and actually, you have a secondary appointment with Hawksworth Blood Center now, so you're part of all of our meetings. You have to come to.
Oh, I love it.
But then every Monday we have a update. With you guys, and it's just fabulous. It's great teaching for the fellows, and it's great always talking to you, Dr. King, Dr. Drock. Great organization and expertise from Children's Hospital. It really makes the fellowship so much stronger. So
agreed.
I want to thank you so much for your time and for being such a great partner.
Thank you.
You're listening to In the Know with Dr. O.